Again, Medical Education Podcast listeners, this is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, calling you today from an early morning in Vancouver, but we'll be speaking with a colleague who's ending her workday in the Netherlands. The voice you'll hear momentarily is Caroline Zeilbach, who with her co-authors has a paper coming out in the September 2020 issue of Medical Education entitled Learning in the Workplace, Use of Informal Feedback Cues in Doctor-Patient Communication. Caroline, thank you for making the time to talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really thrilled to discuss the paper with you.
Me too. I know this is work that you're doing now as part of your assistant professorship in the Department of Education Research and Development at Maastricht University, but you also completed your PhD in Maastricht, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this is correct. Yeah, indeed. The paper was the last study, actually, of my PhD.
Oh, wonderful. And it's an exciting paper for reasons that we'll get to, but I just wanted to highlight right off the top that even some of the methodological issues around going and observing patients and their interactions with physicians to better understand what's going on in lifetime is fairly unique in our field.
Yeah, I guess so. I also have to say that for me, it was the first time that I actually did observations. I had interviewed physicians and patients before, but for me, it was also a new journey which I embarked on when starting this study.
Well, congratulations on your PhD. And I guess before we get into that, we should tell people what you're actually looking for while you were doing those observations. I trust your entire dissertation then was built around this issue of learning in the workplace, and wonder if you might give people a little background on what your studies showed that led you to the point of this particular study.
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. So my PhD was focusing mainly on physicians' lifelong learning. So I looked into how this can be supported, and indeed the workplace was one of the key components there. So basically we started off with looking into different recertification systems as they are implemented within Europe and outside Europe surely as well, although then with a different term being used, such as maintenance of competence or relicensing or recertification. And yeah, throughout that PhD project, indeed one of the main results which we found was that physicians felt that somehow the recertification system that was in place often did not entirely align with their daily practice. So physicians which I had interviewed for previous studies often had indicated that they learned most actually through their work and at their workplace. So this was then also why we came up with the idea of really trying to observe physicians in their workplace in interaction with patients. Before we conducted this study, also interviewed patients and asking them on what kind of role they would want to play in evaluating physicians and in giving them feedback for the purpose of lifelong learning. So this kind of all in all came nicely together. And as I said, this particular piece which we were discussing today is then the fourth and last study of my PhD, where I observed physicians in their workplace and how they used informal feedback cues in communicating with their patients.
And that latter bit, the use of informal feedback cues in doctor-patient communication, was there something that led you to focus specifically on that aspect of these interactions from your previous work?
It was mostly actually that we focused on communication because we felt communication is one of the hardest skills probably to learn. It's very complex, but a very crucial skill in daily practice of physicians. And it's often developed through practice and through informal learning. So considering that it's such a complex but crucial skill, we do also see that most patient complaints actually address physicians' communication skills. So that's why we thought then we focus on physicians' communication skills. Another reason was that we thought something as knowledge, for instance, medical knowledge, it's not really something which you can observe in practice. So this was kind of the reason that we thought, okay, let's look into how physicians interact with different patients and whether that changes, whether we are able to observe different cues they seem to react to, which they then kind of give meaning to and then learn from this.
And let's use that to jump back to the methodological issue then. You did conduct interviews, but as I said, one of the less common strategies that we see in our literature is the actual observation of patient interactions. And I think more people consider doing that than actually go through with it and quickly throw up their hands, assuming that they won't be allowed by their ethics board or there'll be privacy issues. How did you manage to run an observational study like this?
I have to say it was really not that complicated actually to get the ethical approval. I mean, I think maybe that was partly due to the fact that I had asked for ethical approval before, and so I kind of knew what aspects to consider. And as I said, I'd also conducted a study where I interviewed patients for, so I think at least at that stage it felt that that previous study was the participants there because they were patients who were much more vulnerable and needed to be protected, and maybe even more than physicians in this study here. So I think maybe I was kind of aware of the ethical issues I would needed to consider. But then when it came to asking for ethical approval, obviously there were certain aspects which we needed to keep in mind. And surely one of the points where we got questions from the ethical review board was indeed how we would protect the patients. For instance, questions whether we would also need the informed consent from patients. But in the end, we didn't need to do that, since if we would ask them for informed consent, we would collect information and data from the patients. And that was not the idea behind it. We did, however, inform the patients of the respective physicians I observed beforehand so that they could make an informed decision on whether I should be present in the room. So in this way, they could say that they were not comfortable with me observing their consultation. And actually, I think in the end, it was only one patient, I think, or maybe two, who did not feel comfortable with me being in the room. So then I would just leave before the patient would enter so that I wouldn't even see the patient beforehand. So those were just some practical points, but also some questions which we got in advance from the ethical board. In that way, I think that the way it started was that we asked ethical approval from the Dutch Medical Education Review Board to have that first. And then we also went to the two local ethical review boards of the respective hospitals where we did the observations.
And we're talking about one or two out of 100 patients approached then, because you've had quite a large number of interactions that were observed. So that's quite a high success rate in terms of people being willing to participate.
Yeah, it's true. And what we actually noticed was that I think patients were very positive, I think, about it. Some, I think, might have mistaken me with a resident, even though we had made it clear in the information letter for the patient that I do not have a medical background, so I wasn't able to make a clinical judgment on what was discussed. But you could see that some were aware of me being present in the room, some others less. But I feel overall they were always really eager also. A lot of patients actually mentioned that their physician was a really good one, that he or she was very competent, or that they were doing a good job in that way.
Excellent. And you went in looking for these communication skills and trying to observe the sorts of learning that took place in response to those interactions. You alluded to the fact that it can be difficult to detect knowledge in observing a patient interaction. I imagine there are also some inferences that need to be drawn in terms of what aspect of communication skill might be being demonstrated at any one time, and or what cue might be taken on board by the physician. How did you sort out what behaviors were meaningful representations of what you were trying to study?
When I was doing the observations, I was really trying to observe and take notes of changes in communication. And that was often either within one consultation, but also specifically across different consultations. So I was really interested in looking how one physician would kind of use different communication strategies between patients, but also, for instance, what would happen and how a physician would react and often then adapt the communication if there was a cue, if you want to say it like that, from the patient. So for instance, when a patient would either get nervous or start crying, or also when the physician kind of knew that the consultation was about delivering bad news. So it was often about that, and that was also one of the quotes actually from the physicians, the kind of mental preparation the physicians did before communicating, for instance, or delivering bad news or communicating a new therapy or a new alternative treatment.
So that implies that they were fairly deliberate in the way that they were adjusting. At least in some circumstances, they went into a particular context and anticipating that a communication strategy might be more effective than a different one. But I'm curious as to the informal cues, the things that were occurring in live time that led to some adjustments. Do you mind elaborating on those a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So what we noticed was that they anticipated a reaction from the patient and then would change their communication. So it kind of planned way, but there were also lots of ad hoc adjustments in the way they communicated. And those informal ones, I mean, those really differed. And there were a couple of factors which the adjustment would depend on. So for instance, whether there already was a relationship established between the patient and the physician. But for instance, also the mood of both patient and physician. It often also depended on the diagnosis which a physician would need to give. But also it could be just very circumstantial cues, such as the setup of the room, or for instance, whether the telephone would be ringing, whether someone else would enter the room, or whether there would be two patients or even more in the room, being the family members, or whether they would ask a question or just give a certain reaction, which then the physician hadn't anticipated before and then reacted to it, or decided not to react to it, because that was also something which we observed. And I think just coming back to the question you asked previously about the method we chose, I felt that especially the combination of doing the observations first and then afterwards doing the interviews was very enriching to really just understand those changes in communication which I observed.
Yeah, the pairing, I imagine, was very helpful in terms of unpacking a little bit about what you were observing. And the last thing I want to ask you about in terms of those particular observations that you drew out of it was, you used this phrase in the paper, communication repertoire, that physicians generated a repertoire of communication strategies, is the way I interpreted it, in a way that aligns very well with, I think, how people often talk about expertise in the medical knowledge sense, that the expert isn't one who has a particular effective strategy, they're one who can flexibly adjust. How did that show up in communication skills that you were paying particular attention to?
I think that it became really obvious when the physician would indeed change the communication strategy or the use of the repertoire. So it was really the shifting between different patients, but it was also shifting in the moment. So for instance, if there would be a patient who would burst out in tears, I saw that the physician would then automatically make use of, that was my interpretation of it then, and based on the analysis we've then done, but would automatically make use of the established communication repertoire to really just play into that situation, which is developed without really anticipating it potentially. So I think it is really this flexible use of the communication repertoire, and in this way also kind of with every patient anew, checking if the repertoire is still in this way kind of up to date, or whether it would need to be adjusted slightly. So in this way, the reaction to different cues would either strengthen the communication repertoire or would lead to refinement. There were so many different situations, and I think that's just very characteristic of the study also, which just underlined that there was this need of physicians to really just be flexible and really break the pattern in this way.
Yeah, well, and that says to me that we have a lot to learn from this work in terms of helping students appreciate that it's not about learning a single model, but about, you know, developing a repertoire of strategies that can be adapted depending on the circumstances. And so that leads me to my last question, which is, what are you doing with these results now that you better understand the way physicians are adapting educationally? What's your primary goal in terms of trying to help learners become better?
I think that we can use this to still support learners in being more aware of what they can actually learn from the daily practice. And I do realize that I say that as a non-medical specialist or non-medically trained someone. But I do think it just underlines the importance of regular reflection on communication or whatever other performance at stake. Yeah, and this way, you know, just self-monitor your own behavior and your own way of doing things, and to reflect on that and asking yourself whether this is, yeah, not really wanting to speak in right and wrong here, but if this would be a suitable approach, or whether there would need to be a refinement needed of that repertoire which someone used. And I think, at least from what I saw in the observations and what I also noticed during the interviews, is that not everyone has the same sensitivity to pick up those different cues and is able to shift or being reflective and aware of everything which is happening. And I think this kind of also comes logically if you consider just how hectic practice can be, and that sometimes one is just preoccupied with the workload or with time pressure. But I think that the results can highlight and can help learners in a way of really raising awareness of the importance and also the opportunities of learning in the workplace. And I think that can also lead to a collaborative effort, because I think discussing either different cases with colleagues or different communication strategies, or maybe also just observing a colleague in daily practice just to kind of see what communication strategies someone else uses, can be very helpful in just reflecting on one's own communication repertoire.
Excellent. This is a longer conversation than usual because there are just so many aspects of this paper that I want to continue asking you about. But I think in the interest of keeping things relatively brief and keeping the file fairly small for those who are listening, I will wrap up, but just highlight that there's a lot more to learn from this paper than we're able to cover in this short period of time. So those who are intrigued and want to learn more about Caroline's work, you'll find it in the September 2020 issue of Medical Education under the title Learning in the Workplace, Use of Informal Feedback Cues in Doctor-Patient Communication, and Caroline Zeilbach is the first author on that work. So I'll wrap things up, but thank you very much, Caroline, and best of luck with your continued studies.
Thank you, Kevin, very much, and thank you also for discussing the paper with me.